Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, Labor Day, the 6th of September. We, this hour of the program, have all things political, and Melissa Harris-Lacewell is our guest the first hour of our program today. She's been with us quite a few times. She's an associate professor of politics and African-American studies at Princeton University, author of the award-winning book Barbershops, Bibles, and BET, Everyday Talk and Black Political Thought. And she's currently working on a new book, Sister Citizen, a text for colored girls who've considered politics when being strong wasn't enough. She is a contributor to MSNBC, providing commentary frequently on U.S. elections, racial issues, religious questions, and gender concerns for The Rachel Maddow Show and Countdown with Keith Olbermann. And she writes a monthly column for The Nation magazine titled Sister Citizen and is a regular contributor at TheNation.com. Big day politically here in the state of Wisconsin. President Obama will be in Milwaukee this afternoon, and he plans to announce a six-year plan to revamp the roads, railways, and runways of this country with a $50 billion upfront investment to jumpstart job creation. This is according to the White House. He will be speaking on Wednesday in Cleveland, and this is a speech in which he will propose making permanent the business tax credits for research, which the White House says would cost $100 billion over 10 years and would be paid for by ending some corporate tax breaks. We'll look at this. Is it time for the president to give a primetime national speech on the economy? Why is the unemployment rate persistently high in this country? We'll be talking about the midterm elections a great deal this hour. Is there a good chance the GOP will take over the House? Is there a possibility they will take over the Senate? Of course, we've got negotiations between Prime Minister Netanyahu and Palestinian Authority President Muad Abbas going on. Will those be likely to be fruitful? All that and more this hour, Labor Day with Melissa Harris-Lacewell. Here's our phone number for you to join the conversation. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And the email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Harris-Lacewell, hello. Happy Labor Day.
Happy Labor Day.
Yeah, thank you. The president's going to be in our city this afternoon talking about this $50 billion infrastructure job plan. A couple questions for you. Why is it, do you think, that the economy is so darn sluggish? And why has he not presented some very large program to get people back to work?
That's the million-dollar question. Maybe it was Paul Krugman you wanted to be talking to this morning. So, clearly, the reason that our economy is taking such a very long time to rebound, and particularly on the job creation front, is because in many ways we have simply deferred or experienced only in some sectors a pain that has been coming really for two decades now, and that is the transition of our economy from the industrial economy, the one that was stimulated by World War II, that put people to work in jobs, in factories, making things, that encouraged labor unions to organize and make sure that those laborers had living decent wages, quality, health care availability, the ability to buy homes, all of those things that we actually celebrate today on Labor Day. And now we've moved into an entirely different economy, a global economy, an economy where information and where service sector jobs are far more important than jobs in industrial and sort of making things arenas. And we are never, ever, ever going to once again be a country that is primarily industrial in its job creation. We haven't quite figured out how to respond to the new economy in which we find ourselves. It's been coming now for, again, 20 or 30 years, but in a very crisis situation, we now find ourselves facing this deferred pain of a shifting economy.
Mm-hmm. Considering the political climate in Washington right now, Melissa, do you think that he has any chance of getting passage of such a $50 billion upfront investment? And then later this week, evidently, he's going to be talking about making permanent business tax credits for research. Also may talk about a payroll tax holiday, tax cuts for the middle class, and increasing money for clean energy. As you well know, it's been pretty hard to do much of anything. Will that continue, do you think?
Yeah, it will be hard. And here's part of why it's hard. Look, the way that World War II and the New Deal stimulated new jobs was through infrastructure, right? It had to do with basically these huge WPA projects that put people to work.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly there were many folks, myself included, who was calling for kind of infrastructure as a consensus item that would lead Democrats and Republicans into a place where everyone could agree that the bridges need to be rebuilt and the roads need to be repaved and that we had work to do on the dams and the buildings and all of that. But the fact is, even that, which we saw in part in some of the stimulus package money that came through the states, is government work. In other words, those are jobs that are government jobs given to people, again, to either build infrastructure or even hiring in new bureaucracies. Government sector can grow based on what government does. It is much harder for the government to have a role in creating private sector jobs. Now, of course, the challenge there means that Republicans can consistently say, government is getting big. It's too big. Look how huge and big government is. When, in fact, what government is citizens working. But as long as there's a really powerful capacity to say government's growing and the private sector is shrinking, it's a kind of political anxiety that makes it difficult to do the work of growing the one place where government has control over growing jobs, and that is in the public sector.
Mm-hmm. And yet the news we got last week was that there are more private sector jobs, but a decline in government jobs. And you have a lot of people running for office who are as you know, states are not doing very well, and some people are saying that some of these public jobs could be cut. It seems to me as though those are jobs as well.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, as someone who studies African-American politics, one of the things I'm always sensitive to about public sector jobs is, of course, the public sector is precisely where the African-American middle class emerged. Mm. It was basically post office jobs and teaching jobs, which are, you know, government jobs that created an African-American middle class after the 1960s. And so there's real ways in which public sector jobs can have this positive impact on our overall economy. On the other hand, folks want to see the private sector growing. And again, in part it's about putting people to work, but it's also partly about just how Americans see ourselves and our understanding of ourselves as kind of an entrepreneurial country and a place where, you know, an ordinary person can have a good idea, make a profit, and move, you know, have class mobility. And that has increasingly become a rare story for Americans.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a chance the Republicans will take over the House, maybe the Senate?
The chance is stronger in the Senate, obviously, than in the House, and it's simply a greater probability that they can take over the Senate, both because the Senate tends to fluctuate between parties more easily and readily, and also, of course, because the margin of majority is much narrower in the Senate. I think it's possible that the GOP could win control of the House. But I do think it remains, even at this moment, unlikely. And I say that simply because when we look at midterm races, race to race, at this point, there's still a slim majority for Democrats. Remember that when Democrats retook the House in 2006, they mostly retook it by replacing generally moderate Republicans with pretty conservative Democrats in districts that we would have to understand is pretty purple.
Mm-hmm.
So what that means is that there's a lot of relatively junior, quite vulnerable Democrats who could be ousted by simply returning those Republicans or what would have been Republican incumbents a few years ago back to office. But because there were some more gains on the coattails of Barack Obama in 2008, there is a little bit more sort of room, margin for error there. My bet is that we'll have a very, very slim Democratic majority in the House going into the next congressional session.
And what about these Tea Party candidates? Are there a significant number of elections, Melissa, where Tea Party candidates have won and they're simply too far to the right for the general electorate?
You know, that certainly would be the case in a presidential election year, right? So we know in a presidential election year, a ton of independents and new voters and all those kinds of folks come out because their attention is highly focused on the presidential race. And those kinds of voters tend to be pretty much in the middle. And so if you have candidates that are too far to the right or to the left in the primary, they are highly likely to lose in the general election. That same logic doesn't quite hold for midterm elections. Midterm elections, particularly at a moment like this, when people are feeling so frustrated with government overall and when they're feeling pretty stressed out by the economy, you know, the folks who turn out are pretty partisan. They're highly informed. They're a much smaller segment of voters than what you get in a presidential election year, which simply means that people who are more on the fringes of their party are less vulnerable in a midterm election year. That said, I do think that that the Tea Party has yet to prove that it is truly an electoral force. It clearly is a media force, but it's not yet an electoral one.
Finally, before we go to phone calls, you wrote recently in The Nation a very interesting piece about words in reference to Glenn Beck's Restoring Honor rally in Washington. A man is not the leader of a social movement, you write, just because many thousands heed his call, arrive at the Washington Mall and listen to a rambling, self-righteous, utterly forgettable speech. Just ask Mr. Farrakhan. Couple questions for you. Why did so many thousands come to the mall? Taylor Branch wrote an interesting piece in the Times, I'm sure you saw yesterday, in which he says it could have been a lot worse. There could have been a lot of political statements, a lot of hatred there, but he somehow got an epiphany when he met with, which is a strange story, the niece of Martin Luther King, which is odd. So he's totally changed directions here. What was going on at that rally?
Well, look, from America's founding, you know, one of the things that even international observers have consistently said about us is that we are surprisingly engaged. We really like to show up. We like to talk about what's going on. We like to organize. It's part of, I think, you know, the fundamental health of our democracy. And so in a certain way, I'm not at all, I mean, truly, not only not distressed, but I know this is going to sound nuts, pleased to see the Glenn Beck rally, because at least what it means is that folks are maintaining an engagement with the idea that our politics matters and that having a voice in our government is an important part of what it means to be a citizen. But I will say that as I described it, rambling and largely self-righteous speech was also indicative of, to me, a sort of failure to understand that on the one hand, we certainly need engagement, but that engagement has to be around structural issues. One of the reasons I compared the Beck rally to the Farrakhan rally in 1995, the Million Man March, isn't because I think the same things motivate it, but rather because that march in 1995 was also surprisingly apolitical. It was a march of African-American men who showed up and said, we need to do better. We need to get jobs, rather than the 1963 march under the direction of Martin Luther King and Bayard Rustin and others that said, the government needs to do better. The government needs to be sure that there's fair access to jobs. And see, to me, that distinction between a recognition that what we face as our challenges are structural and require real policy change versus this kind of strange, self-helpy, oh, if only we had honor and goodness and joy and light. It's just, for me, a kind of misplaced place way to think about how to organize politically.
Professor Melissa Harris-Lacewell, our guest for all things political on this Labor Day. She's Associate Professor of Politics, African American Studies at Princeton University, frequent contributor on MSNBC, and she also writes a column and writes regularly for The Nation. One line is open if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our show this Labor Day, the author of The Company Town, The Industrial Edens and Satanic Mills That Shaped the American Economy. These weren't all places that we think about when we think of Tennessee Ernie Ford. Remember that song, 16 Tons, What Do You Get? Another Day Older and Deeper in Debt. Some of these places were utopian, but they were also a little paternalistic. So it'll be an interesting conversation. Maybe you've lived in some of these towns. Hour number two. Professor Melissa Harris-Lacewell, our guest this hour. We start our calls with David from Eau Claire. Hello, David.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, it's great to talk to you both. And I just had a couple comments. One question is, I'm a supporter of Obama, generally speaking, but what I'd like to see him do, and maybe be the leader of this effort, is some kind of urban Marshall Plan. Because just recently, when I've gone to some of our great cities like Milwaukee and Cleveland and Detroit and Kansas City, it just seems as though, again, there's just a lot of issues with both the infrastructure and getting people back to work. And so one of my hopes for Obama was that he would be a person that would stand tall on looking at the problems in American cities as far as development goes. Because I think as far as competitiveness, if we don't have a full engagement of the workplace in those cities, that is really where we could grow our economy very well and also just build the image of America, again, as a place where the urban cities are where a lot of the productive capacity is doing very well. And my other just quick question was just thinking about a similar issue with the Tea Party, and the fact is that we have a more diverse country than we did 50 years ago and continuing to become more diverse. And it's clearly not an ethnically diverse movement. So I was wondering just your thoughts about, is this something that's going to get more in the conversation as we get closer to the election?
Thanks, David.
Well, as a city person, I'm currently living in Sumter, New Jersey, but I lived in Chicago for 7 years. I live half-time in New Orleans, and I think of myself as a city person. And so I am in complete agreement with your caller in the sense that I had high hopes that President Obama, as a Chicagoan, would be a very urban president. I find it exciting, for example, that when my president goes home, he heads to a city. And I think that Chicago is a city that in many ways captures both the best and the worst of what cities can be. Incredible downtown revitalization, but also these stark differences of class and race and ethnicity in the city. And again, as someone who loves New Orleans, clearly questions of infrastructure, everything from levees to roads to sort of the bringing back of urban education, all of those things are very near to me and dear. Here's part of what I think has happened, or two things. One, when President Obama came in and they moved very quickly to move the stimulus package through, that stimulus package went to states. And one of the things we know about state legislatures is that they are notoriously difficult relative to the cities that exist within those states. There is consistently, in these legislatures and governors who are trying to balance these issues, will often make choices that that don't give enough resources, credit, benefit to the cities the kind of anchoring cities in those states. So when the money goes to Illinois instead of to Chicago, when it goes particularly to Louisiana instead of to New Orleans, then we saw a maldistribution, I think, of many of that stimulus package dollars. The other thing is that over the past 20 years, the word urban has also been hijacked by the right to mean poor, violent, and people of color. So you could say urban schools or urban problems, and you're not actually talking about a city center. You're talking about a kind of discriminatory discourse about people of color and about poor people. And so it makes it difficult for a Democratic president, particularly an African-American Democratic president, to start talking about cities because the language has been so coded in this kind of racialized way. Which, of course, brings us to the second half of the question. Of course, we are in a far more diverse country, and the fact is that neither Democrats nor Republicans have sufficiently figured out how to think about building electoral coalitions that truly cross the many ethnic and linguistic and racial lines in this country.
One of the reasons why nobody really wants to take up this immigration issue, right? That's really playing out in a nasty way.
You know, it's the immigration thing for me is horrifying, and Labor Day is a good moment to pause and think about this, not only because our country was obviously built on immigrant labor, European immigrant labor, the labor of those African immigrants who were involuntarily immigrated to the United States as slaves, but also because our economy now rests on the backs of both migrant workers and undocumented workers in this country. Pretend anything otherwise is just a bizarre refusal to acknowledge the laboring efforts of men and women in this country who are often working for very low wages in very difficult and vulnerable circumstances. And so to vilify the most vulnerable, to go after them in an election year, and not only to vilify them, but also their children and their families, I think it borders on the obscene.
Mm-hmm. And then to make comments, what's with this story of beheadings? And I didn't know that had been a part of Brewer's political rhetoric, and it wasn't true. And it's just, why would you say horrendous things like that to scare people, and it simply isn't true?
You know, I think this has been part of what's been difficult for me as someone who first entered the public arena in the new media age. On the one hand, I really like the democratic with a little d realities of new media. I like that a smart person with enough gumption to get up and blog every morning can develop an audience without having to be blessed by a major network or an existing publication. So I really like the ways in which new media provides space for lots of new and diverse voices. But I also worry about the ways that new media has degraded the fundamental precepts of journalism. Listen, people are busy. They have kids to raise and homes to try to save from foreclosure and jobs to try to find. And you have to be able to believe that when you pick up a paper or turn on the radio or catch 30 minutes of television in the evening, that you're getting basically true representations of actions and of facts. Now, you know, you may watch things that are ideologically based one way or another, but you got to believe that if someone says X happened, that it happened, or that if A went to war with B, that A, in fact, went to war with B. Now, you know, different commentators will say whether it was good or bad, but the fact that people from the Shirley Sherrard case on are willing to simply lie and misrepresent and mislead, I think that is the danger of new media, which encourages, you know, a lack of editorial review, a lack of follow-up of facts, and a lack of basic journalistic ethics.
Ray is next in Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
I want to touch on the statement your guest said earlier in the show about we can forget about building things in this country, and we're just all going to be tapping away on our keyboards, and food will magically appear out of the computer screen. The information technology has brought to this country iPods and Facebook. iPods are made where, and how many really good jobs have been produced by Facebook? Most of that money goes to the founders of these companies. iPods are now produced where? In China, India? They're not produced in the United States, ma'am. And anybody knows the Chinese and the Indians are teaching their students far quicker and better computer sciences than we're getting here. So anything that we're going to plan on in the future to do information technology to save our industrial base, that can all be outsourced via the Internet. So what we need is an even-handed look. We have to have information technologies, but we also have to have jobs for people who are not computer technicians, people who work with their hands, which is about half of this nation, ma'am. If we need a broom, we should make the broom in the United States, not import it from China for slave labor. If we need a tank, We should build the tank here and all its subcomponents.
All right. I'm not sure you were listening to her that carefully, but if you would like to respond, Professor Harris-Lacewell.
Oh, look, the passion that I hear from this caller, I think maybe I was just somewhat misunderstood, but the passion is just precisely, I think, my point, that the outsourcing that your caller is talking about, both the information technology outsourcing and the realities of construction being outsourced, is precisely my point about how difficult our current global economy is. And the point about food, for example, I think is a critically important one. I did absolutely, as I was making this kind of industrial versus information technology, I left out clearly the agricultural element. But I think my point simply is that our economy will not come back. It will never rest again on the kinds of jobs that, for example, my grandfather did. Those jobs are gone. And so what I would agree with the caller about is we need to think about what are the things that we can build here. My bet is that we won't build brooms here, that because labor can be found so much more cheaply in other countries, the realities of how the global marketplace works means that it will be outsourced. So we have to think about, I agree, how we have a diverse economy, one that includes both the capacity of people to work with their hands and for people to work with their minds, and to work with their minds and hands together, obviously. And we have to be critical about protecting labor practices for all of those different groups, educating our population for all of it, and absolutely maintaining a strong agricultural base, because I do agree that we've got to be able to produce food to feed the people of our country.
Here's an email from Jim in Colfax. It seems clear to me that the Democrats' best issue is this. Republicans and their radio TV allies want Obama to fail. They want the Democrats to fail. And will do everything in their power to make it happen. And by extension, they are willing to let America itself fail. Why aren't the Democrats talking about this?
Yeah, this, you know, let me just say, I don't think that this is just one-sided. I think that political parties who are out of power want to be in power. It's their job. Political parties want to get folks elected. And so there has been, I think, a decline in our ability to talk about patriotism, not as a kind of nationalistic and militaristic flag waving, but instead patriotism meaning that we want our country to prosper no matter who has won the latest election. The reality of a diverse ideological nation like our own is that everyone will sometimes be in power and sometimes be out. We had founders who, for all of their failings, did create a system that made it safe to be out of power. And that's not a small point. In much of the world, if your political or ethnic or linguistic party is out of power, it's actually not safe. This is, you know, what coups and wars and refugee resettlements look like over and over in the world, is that if one party wins, then every one of the out party is no longer safe. It's an incredible thing to be an American where, in fact, you can be out of power and yet be basically secure in your country. So what we have to do is protect those fundamental civil liberties and civil rights that make it possible for out-groups to shout and yell and also make it possible for in-groups to govern and get something done. The thing is, it's not pretty. It doesn't lead to fast turnaround. It means that we have a very slow and lumbering political system. But I'm not sure that Democrats should simply, you know, in the midterms kind of point to Republicans and say, you guys are the bad guys, you should support us no matter what because we're the party in power. I think that Democrats are going to have to show that they have better ideas. They're going to have to talk about all of the amazing things that they've accomplished in the past 20 months. And they're going to have to knock on a million doors to win these elections.
A million doors.
Overall, a million doors to win these elections.
Thanks, Ray. Todd in Summit Lake. Hi.
Hi there. I wanted to call up to tell you that this is not President Obama's fault. I wanted to apologize and tell you that it's my fault because every time I want to buy something and I go to the Walmart, even if it's only a nickel cheaper, I'll buy something made far away instead of things made in our local community. And even though Ford, Chrysler, and General Motors have made the vehicle of the year for 3 years in a row, I don't even try them out. I drive Hondas and Toyotas, foreign cars, and my high union wage has really forced my job overseas. And it certainly wasn't President Bush's fault either, because he had a good economy for 7 years and had less than 5% unemployment, even though about 5 or 6% of people are unemployable. So, again, I'm just calling to apologize that the problem with the economy is my fault because I don't buy things made locally that support my neighbors.
All right. Melissa.
Well, I mean, it you know, I assume there's a little tongue-in-cheek there.
Right.
But there's also a really important point that we have power as consumers. And that, you know, the kinds of choices that we make as consumers can reflect our political and ethical and moral commitments. And I think that's important. It's certainly been part of, for example, how the environmental movement has encouraged Americans to be environmentalists by consuming certain kinds of things, by personally recycling certain kinds of things. And that's been great, and it makes a dent. But I have to say that, you know, over and over again, it really is the structural constraints and inducements that make a difference. So, yes, feel free to continue to recycle your plastic, but the fact is that our environmental changes will have to come from what corporations are doing. And certainly, you should buy local when you have the opportunity, but the other part of it has to do with how we have encouraged businesses like Walmart to exist and the ways in which Walmart is allowed to engage in a set of labor practices that then undercut local businesses. So I think, you know, yes, I agree that we can make ethical and even patriotic consumption choices, but I also know that many of these choices have got to be made at a broader structural level, which means they have to be made at the level of government.
Thanks for your call. Ken in Oshkosh, hi.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, Ken.
I thought the lady was going to get into this when she made her opening statement, but she didn't. I believe a large part of this, perhaps not even realized by the military-industrial complex, is that automation and robotics is creating a pressure on the entire economy. The only thing cheaper than a robot would be a peasant in the, you know, northern reaches of China. And in part, they're blindly almost reaching towards this. With globalization, they've essentially disconnected even the rather conundrum type of systems they had for relationship of value to fiscal and monetary policy. But in turn, you also have this pressure. They have no idea how to have an economy where automation and the robot are going to have the majority of the work that's being done. And so, in turn, they are searching around for labor markets. They're trying to reduce everything to the same price that you could get an automated robot to do the job.
Professor Harris-Lacewell.
Yeah, it's not a small point. I mean, clearly robotics and automation, you know, consistently have had an impact really since mid-century forward on a variety of different kinds of jobs. You know, think about the fact that there were once typing pools, and now everyone has, you know, their own computer sitting on their desk, and so all of those secretarial jobs are gone. On the other hand, of course, they also begin to produce new sorts of jobs because somebody has to design, you know, new and larger robotics. So I think that in certain ways that goes with my connection between the shift in our economy. But let me also say this. You know, it just may be possible, and gosh, Americans, we hate this. It may be possible that part of how we will bring back a balance is that we'll have to simply have less. It is our sort of manifest destiny history. Our understanding of ourselves is always pushing forward into more land and more people and bigger buildings. But it is possible that the way we bring balance is by everyone having less, driving smaller cars and living in somewhat smaller homes and purchasing fewer items and simply allowing ourselves to recognize that that the status that comes from consumption is not in and of itself the thing that makes us Americans. It's not just the kitchen wars anymore. And I think that shift, one that says that an affluent lifestyle is a much more modest lifestyle, I think is a particularly difficult sell for any politician, because what politicians do is tell people, your life is going to be better. You're going to be able to buy more things. You'll have a bigger home. And it just isn't very palatable to be able to say, listen, we're in a kind of recession that requires us to to simply have less.
Mm-hmm. It's another one of those things that we tend to learn as we're getting old, don't we? That the older you get, the more you say, I got way too much stuff.
Way too much. And I mean, really, like, as a country, it's just, it is one of the things that is always such an adjustment whenever I travel overseas, is just how much, how many fewer resources Europeans, Africans, Asians consume person to person. Smaller showers, you know, smaller buildings, just the idea of how much space a family needs. And these have been shifting ideas in America. The idea that every child needs their own bedroom simply was not true for most of American history. Children of the same sex all shared the same bedroom. Heck, even in my lifetime, that was true.
Mm-hmm.
But now the idea of what an affluent family is, or a family that is giving their children the best, the idea is that they would give every child their own bedroom, which obviously means enormous homes that cost a great
right.
deal to heat, to cool. So in every way, we may just need to think about having less.
Right. Before we take a brief pause, here's an email from Jerry Ann who says, I admire Professor Lacewell so much and appreciate her fine intellect and insight. I'm going to wake up my husband this Labor Day morning so he can listen to the program, too. Do you think he should sleep in or should she wake him up?
I totally think he should sleep in. I have to say it's incredibly kind. I get a tremendous amount of hate mail, so I always am very appreciative of any piece of nice mail.
Well, that's a very nice piece of mail. Let's welcome more phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Professor Melissa Harris Lacewell. She's Associate Professor of Politics and African American Studies at Princeton University, and she's also a contributor to MSNBC. You see her on The Rachel Maddow Show and Keith Olbermann, and also NBC Nightly News. I saw her on that last week talking about Katrina. 5 years later, she is a columnist for The Nation and blogs for The Nation as well. It's Labor Day morning. President will be in Milwaukee today. We've been talking about that. We have to still talk about yet another attempt to achieve some kind of peace in the Middle East. The administration has taken that on, whether or not that's a worthy pursuit or doomed to failure, as so many other such meetings haven't gone very far. And a little bit, but not the breakthrough everybody's wanted. And whatever you'd like to discuss. 800-486-8655. talk@WPR.org is the email. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to Deborah in Madison next. Hi, Deborah.
Hello. Professor Lacewell, I would be interested to hear what you think about why on earth the Equal Rights Amendment has completely vanished from the political landscape. And why we continue to allow the rights of greater than 50% of our population to still not be guaranteed by our Constitution.
No,
it's been sidetracked completely, and no one talks about it anymore.
You know, it's stunning. I teach, in part, gender politics and women's politics and feminist politics on campus. And this year, a group of students at Princeton University came to me, young women, and this is a campus that, of course, didn't have women until the mid-1970s, even admitted to Princeton. And now they're just over 50% of the student body population. Princeton women are at the moment in some very public positions. Elena Kagan, Michelle Obama, and of course Sonia Sotomayor are all Princeton women. And yet, no woman on Princeton University's campus, and by the way, we also have a woman president at Princeton, and yet no woman on our campus ran for student government president. Not only did they not win, they didn't even run.
Oh, my.
And so these women came to me and said, oh, my goodness, how could such a thing have happened? And would you please teach a class about it? And what I'll say is over and over again, when I've taught this course, when I've talked with female students, so many of them do not, as young women, feel that they have experienced discriminatory gender experiences. They don't believe that there are important structural barriers to their ability to accomplish and have everything that they've thought of. Every young Princeton woman that I talk to has every intention of both being a size six forever, raising all three of her kids, you know, simultaneously with working a high-powered job and having, you know, a perfect spouse, male or female. Like, they just really imagine that it's all possible. And it really isn't until I see them in their 20s and 30s that I start getting from them a discursive analysis about how gender has made some real limitations for them and how difficult it is, in fact, to have all of these things they imagine they'll have. So part of the answer, I think, is that the deep cross-racial gendered impulse from young women to say our country needs to do better by us has largely dissipated and in many ways been replaced by a discourse about how endangered men are. So, for example, in African-American communities, you hear about how endangered black boys are, or you'll hear that, you know, the problems are that, that in fact, girls are outperforming boys in all of these classrooms. And so it just becomes very difficult to create a political movement with the kind of energy that existed 35 years ago about sort of women's issues.
Thank you, Deborah. That's a word I haven't even heard in a long time. Barb in Chippewa Falls, hi.
Good morning, and thank you for having this show. I really enjoy Melissa Harris Lacewell very much on MSNBC. And Rachel, I see when different times you're so measured and so articulate in your things, and sometimes I think, oh, you must be so angry about some of these things. And just a few times I could see where it really kind of got the emotional. But anyway, I really appreciate your measured responses on these tough issues. My question was about an article, and I don't have it in front of me, in The Nation, where you were responding to you have to be taught to hate. Mm-hmm. And I have been a longtime contributor to the Southern Poverty Law Center and see some of the leaders of, you know, movements where there's this real racist, anti-immigration, all of this, and I am curious whether your feeling is, in the year 2010, and this is really sad for me to think this, but do you feel that there are more young people, children, being taught to hate on the basis of, you know, people of color and whatever? I just wondered what your thought is on that.
Thank you. First of all, thank you for your really kind words. It's always funny to me when I hear people who've seen me on television and they say, oh, you're so measured and calm, because I assure you, if you ask any friend and or family member of mine, that is not how they would describe
me. That's not who you are.
So that's just TV, Melissa. There's plenty of yelling and screaming and throwing things that goes on in the house. You know, this point about our racial socialization, I think, is an incredibly important one, in part because we have to balance our emotions about it. You know, on the one hand, as an African-American woman and the child of an interracial family, I have to be an optimist because despite the growth of the prison-industrial complex, despite a 10% unemployment rate, you know, the kind of racial anxiety that flies out of the mouths of people like Dr. Laura on occasion, there is not any moment when my body, a black, young black woman born of a white mother, would ever have been in a position of as much opportunity as I currently am in America. I mean, that is just true. slavery, Jim Crow, the realities of gender inequality, so many of those battles have been fought, and while not won, so that they're not completely won, they certainly are not, I mean, whatever my problems today, they are not the problems of my father growing up in the Jim Crow South, or of my mother who grew up in a repressive religion that told her that as a woman and as a girl, she didn't deserve certain kinds of education. And so it is an incredibly hopeful moment. On the other hand, none of this happens just because time passes. It's not that young people will clearly become more racially open. It's that through struggle and through organizing and through efforts to change policy, we create a world in which young people have more opportunity and more opportunity to interact across racial differences and across linguistic differences and across heterosexual LGBT divides. But it only happens through struggle. So on the one hand, I'm a huge optimist. On the other hand, I also know that we can't sort of rest on it and assume every generation will be more racially progressive than the generation before it. We have to keep doing the work. But there will always be those teaching young people to hate, and yet there will always be the kind of surprising resilience of young people's kind of resistance to that. And I am constantly surprised by how much the daily interactions that I have with real people across racial lines are, for the most part, respectful, encouraging, and leave me, again, generally with a sense of optimism about where we are as a country.
Mm. Thank you, Barb. Here's another email. Bridget in Barrington, she works in a public library and sees people every day who are job hunting. Many of them are laid off from manufacturing and low-skilled jobs. Many are middle-aged and don't have college degrees. These are folks who are angry and will probably vote against incumbents. How do you think they will affect the country, particularly if they are doomed to long-term unemployment?
Yeah, listen, when that part of the American dream dies, when we have a country where people are going to live longer and longer, and yet we're making it impossible for them to live in circumstances of even general comfort, you know, they're losing their homes, they can't help support their children through college, then we create undoubtedly a circumstance that cannot be good for us as a country. We have to renew the ability of people to find work, which both means providing some opportunities for work, and I think that those have to be provided, again, directly through government policy, but also providing some opportunities for retraining and also keeping a strong social safety net, because the fact is some people will be doomed to long-term unemployment, and we can't simply allow people to starve or not have health care or be unable to educate their children because, in fact, they're unemployed. Will they affect the country? No doubt. But I also think that if we simply throw up our hands and imagine that fear is the only impulse driving us, then it is our very fear that creates that. I am consistently surprised by Democrats who just had a historic, world-altering win in 2008, and now are sort of trembling every time they recognize that there's a group of Americans who disagree with them. I mean, of course there is. It's politics. We have an electoral coalition. We just built it. We need to knock the doors. We need to do the work and go out and turn that coalition back out. Part of it is reminding America what has been accomplished, reminding Americans that change takes time, and providing a social safety net so that while Americans are in these tough times, they're not starving, they're not becoming homeless, and they're not being in a circumstance where they're unable to care for their kids.
Right. What do you think about the administration wading into the Middle East peace process again? Are you hopeful that this will be the time there will be a significant agreement?
It certainly is possible. Look, I think you got to try, and then you have to try again. And when you fail, you have to try again. My best friend and dear colleague, Blair Kelly, just published a book called Right to Ride. It's a book about basically the 100 years worth of protests against segregation in public transportation that occurred in the U.S. South among African Americans. And the stunning part about this book is it just tells you that, you know, the civil rights movement didn't begin in the 1950s. It began basically in the 1870s, 1880s, and it failed. And then it failed again, and then it tried again, then it failed again, and then it failed again. And then finally, you know, nearly 100 years later, there's the passage of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. You don't cease the attempt to build a just world and a fair world and a safe world simply because your predecessors have failed. It is the indication that you have to do it again. And the thing is, although I was not supportive of her presidential bid, I actually have tremendous faith in the ability of Hillary Clinton to bring a particular kind of American gravitas to this process. And I would like nothing better than to see Hillary Clinton win a Nobel Prize because, in fact, she's able to bring this about. I'm not saying she should have one now. I'm saying if, in fact, she is part of an architecture that structures a lasting solution in the Middle East, then despite the fact that I was not a supporter of her presidential campaign, I would be the first one cheering and dancing to see her win a prize for that. And let me just also say that we as Americans, if we're going to do that work in the Middle East, we're going to have to very carefully police our anti-Islamic bigotry, particularly relative to the Islamic Cultural Center near 9/11, near Ground Zero. The discourse that has emerged around that, this idea that there is a sacred piece of land that only some people are allowed to be on, that's precisely at the core of so much of the dis-ease in the Middle East. We cannot be producing that here in the United States. We can't be saying, listen, there's some group of people who, because of their identity and its affiliation with a past act of violence, are forever barred from this plot of land, because that is precisely what we are asking other people in the rest of the world to stop doing. So we have to stop that first here before we can even have the moral authority to bring about a lasting peace in the Middle East.
Professor Harris Lacewell, a great pleasure to have you on. Thank you. Happy Labor Day.
Happy Labor Day.
Our guest this hour, Professor Melissa Harris Lacewell. She teaches politics and African-American studies at Princeton University. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this Labor Day show, and to Chrissy Pease for answering phone calls, producing here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee.